This is Kyle Condis here with Creative Disturbance, and this is another episode of the Indie Game Nation podcast, and my guest here is Nathan Ortega.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. I know you're going to be, we'll get to that the end section here in a little bit, but I know you're going to be leaving soon, but I wanted to kind of get, talk to you about everything you've been doing, because a lot of the guests I've had on the show have been a part of the game community or have done stuff that have evolved the game community, but you have kind of gone a different direction.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird path I found. It actually took me a long time to kind of figure out what it is that, one, that I want to do. And I know I wanted to work in the games industry. I've known that since when I was a teenager, really. But I wasn't really sure in what capacity. I think everybody sort of, when they first start dreaming about working in the games industry, they have this aspiration of like, oh, I want to make games. Mm-hmm. And that's a great thing to explore, but I don't think it's for everybody. And it took me a long time to come to the conclusion that that's not where my skill is in terms of, the direct creative aspect of making games. And I eventually, through working years of retail, working at GameStop and other game-specific retails, because I wanted to be close to what I love.
Exactly.
But, it's day job, it pays the bills, but eventually working in retail kind of started making me realize what I am good at. And that's how sometimes not exactly what you think you're good at, mm-hmm. is not necessarily, they sometimes don't gel well. So after working at GameStop for many years, and I currently have been working at a retro video game store, I realized that actually promotions is what I want to be involved in, like helping kind of get the word out on things that I'm passionate about.
And that's what I found out. It's like you do that. I mean, that's been the thing. It's like, whereas people, some going for animation or modeling or
right.
a sound or, programming, you did more of the mass marketing, kind of interviewing and kind of advertising about stuff, like working at the game stores. You've done a couple different podcasts, mm-hmm. One's everybody wants to check out. It's one that's
Dead Pixels podcast.
Thank
yeah.
you. Dead Pixels, which is one where you just kind of go through and do like kind of riffing on kind of really bad video games.
Yeah, we actually, our angle when creating Dead Pixels was sort of a reaction to the cynicism and negativity in the games community proper, mm-hmm. and the lack of real, a lack of being able to appreciate titles from previous years that aren't like game of the year material. Yeah. We always remember the highlights, but we never really go back and find something positive to say about games that are generally critically panned.
Well, I think I almost kind of tied it to like one of the podcasts I listened to. How Did This Get Made?
That was the inspiration for us, actually, because I love that show. Mm-hmm. It and I think that it's a really cool experience to go and look back on titles that we remember from years past and. You even in terrible movies, there are things that you can appreciate about it.
There are some movies I love so much that, they're hidden pleasures. And even though they can be the worst movies, I still love them.
There's and even in a terrible movie, there's interesting cinematography, mm-hmm. or maybe a soundtrack, the score is interesting, or maybe there's little bits that you can appreciate from, the craft of filmmaking that you can kind of glean from that, even if it's generally not a very good movie. But with the games community, we have a hard time really being able to appreciate those things in titles that aren't generally considered classics.
Exactly.
And most of my favorite games from when I was a kid, a lot of them that aren't like your Mario Brothers and Zeldas and things, were games like Fear Effect for the PlayStation 1 or old Nintendo games that just aren't really great generally, but they had something cool about them.
Exactly.
A lot of times for me it was the music, but there are other ideas that are there that, we can actually learn something from those titles. And that was sort of the focus of that, is try to find the good in bad games.
Well, I remember I was listening to you on one of your podcasts, and one of the ones that was a favorite, was not one of the greatest NES games ever made, was the original TMNT. I still had a lot of fun. It was as hard as hell, but
yeah.
I still love and enjoy playing that game.
It's funny, because people go and say that game is terrible, but then, for the same reasons, herald Dark Souls. And I think it's really funny to look back at that, because the same stuff that people say they love about Dark Souls can be applied to Ninja Turtles. Mm. And I think it's just the fact that a lot of people played the original NES Ninja Turtles game when they were six,
yeah.
and they weren't very skilled, and they didn't know what they were doing, because you have to read the manual to even have a clue of what your objectives were. Like, that was that era. You just, the tech was limited, and design ideas didn't always gel and weren't always very intuitive. But it's a really interesting game. And it's hard, but it never is unattainable. It's
exactly.
just, it takes a lot of practice. And I just, that's the game that I always, I get really defensive about it, because I feel people come in on the store I currently work on at, and they go, oh, that Ninja Turtles game, that one was terrible. I'm like, have you played it since you were, since the late 80s? Because I don't think you
have. No, it's the memories of when you were in the 80s of playing the game.
Right, and I guess, and I understand, I was terrible at it too. I never got past that stupid underwater level that everybody remembers.
Really? No, see, I was able to always make it to level 4, the military base.
Yeah, and that's where it just, the difficulty ramps up even further, but... most people never got past the underwater bomb defusing segment, and you know, it took me when I got older, I went back and replayed it and finally got past that. I still haven't beaten it, so it's really hard, but it is really fun and interesting. The design ideas there were kind of I wouldn't say innovative, because that implies that it's such a great design idea that it warrants iteration, but I would love to see that game sort of the core design choices that they went with kind of revisited. Maybe not with the Turtles franchise, but I could see it being a 2D platformer ninja action game with like RPG elements to it. It could be really cool. And that's the thing, is people just generally don't. They just throw the baby out with the bathwater, and it's unfortunate because we miss out on so many cool things just because...
Exactly. You hear word of mouth at the game, like even film music.
Yeah.
Sometimes somebody just says really something negative, and then you realize I should have played it or seen it for myself. Yeah. My own judgment call on it.
Movies, I feel like, because they've been around a lot longer, we kind of accept that not every movie is going to be Oscar material. Mm-hmm. So there's more of a tendency to appreciate interesting things in bad movies, or just movies that are flawed. They have a lot of areas that they stumble, but they have enough it's fascinating about them, about the craft of filmmaking, that you can get past that. But like one of my favorite games the last 5 years was Call of Juarez Gunslinger. Okay. I don't know if you ever played that.
I've heard of it. I haven't played it.
That series is really troubled. It has a lot, they've not really been made a great one so far, but I'm a big Wild West fan.
Okay.
And this game is really cool. It's a little downloadable game built off the engine of the main Call of Juarez titles. It was kind of like the Far Cry Blood Dragon, but with Call of Juarez. But the thing that I love about it is that it's a arcadey first-person Western shooter with like a comic book aesthetic. And the whole thing is that features an unreliable narrator who the levels and the enemies will change depending on what he's... Because the main character narrates everything that's happened to him to basically a bunch of people in this bar. And he forgets details. And whenever the characters correct him, the characters will change or the level design will switch up a bit to reflect him recalling information as he's telling it.
Which system was this on?
It's on PC, PS3, and 360.
Okay.
It's a really, for a $15 game...
So it was an indie title?
It's a downloadable game. Like I said, it's built off the engine from the mainline console Call of Juarez game. So it's like this little sort of side game that you don't have to play the other ones to be able to appreciate. But I loved it. I thought it was really creative, and it actually was a cool spin on an otherwise kind of drab franchise. But again, it's not the game of the year material type of game. It's not innovative. It's just creative and interesting. A lot of people just never touched it, and that's a shame that games like that come out all the time, and people just ignore it because it's not been marketed to them properly.
And this goes right into where I was going to go next, especially with one of your other podcasts, Hitbox, and also you writing for Indie Haven. Basically, you do a lot of research and not advertising, the wrong total word, but like article, right, writing about like indie games.
Yeah.
And I mean, that you really
that's
push
a whole
that.
Field that is just ripe with titles that are unappreciated or unknown. Regardless of the effort put into trying to get it out there, it's just so hard to get people to notice.
What's been some of your awareness in the indie game scene? I mean, maybe just in the last year and a half. Like, I mean, you know, compared, I guess, there's still that whole, like, you know, AAA versus indie.
There's a divide there for sure.
Yeah, but do you think it's growing, or do you think there's still a big divide that just hasn't broken down that wall yet?
I think that as it becomes a more of a proven business model in a lot of ways, the line between AAA and indie is starting to blur, and sort of middle budgeted titles are becoming more and more of a thing. You have things like No Man's Sky being this sort of critical darling, and it was like the star of the show at the Sony's press conference last year. And that's a game developed by five guys who previously made like a Excitebike clone, basically.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, it was called Joe Danger. It was like this kind of cartoony Excitebike or Trials, if you it feels like that. They went from that to this huge, expansive, procedurally generated space exploration game that is getting everybody interested and excited for a title that just... I mean, it came out of nowhere, and now it's the thing that people are most excited for on a platform full of like huge multi-million-dollar projects. So I think that the interest is there because indie games have a lower risk from a financial standpoint. So they're able to take more chances than a lot of big titles that like Assassin's Creed. It seems like right now we're mostly getting very, very safe projects from the AAA space. But it's nice to see that the indies, as they're finding more and more success, they're getting more, they're able to get more money to create ideas they wouldn't have been able to prior.
Well, it's also more freedom of expression for the artists who want to create them too. It's like when you work, and this is something I keep saying every time, it's like when you work for the larger companies, you're put in, I guess maybe sort of a bubble. This is what you're going to be doing for this game.
Yeah.
And with, like, you know, if you look, go back to Super Meat Boy, you have the two guys who had done some indie stuff, and then they just said, screw it, let's make a game for ourselves, and they made this behemoth that came out and just conquered the indie game scene back in 2010 or 11.
Yeah, it's actually really cool because it has that same sort of punk rock aesthetic.
Exactly,
That the music scene or even film, back in the 90s, I think we had a big independent film scene, boom.
Oh, no. It was definitely the mid-90s.
And it's still, I mean, the Hollywood still is a machine that is designed to reduce risk and, maximize profit. So creative voice is hard to have in that field too, just like any other industry. But it's cool to see finally games, the independent scene is actually getting to thrive and diversify more so than it ever has in the past.
Well, then you brought up the indie movie scene. Let me say this, because, back in the mid-90s, you had Kevin Smith, and you had Quentin Tarantino, Clerks and Reservoir Dogs and, Pulp Fiction. And there was this definitely indie scene of film. And there was indie movie houses, and there was definitely a separate genre, movies being made for 70 grand or 100 grand.
Right.
And now it's like, even though there are still sort of indie movies, they're kind of mishmashed with the theaters now. Like, even the couple indie movie theaters we have show mainstream pictures.
Right.
And I think there's still a market, but do you think there will ever be a day when, like, the indie game scene will be kind of tied in with the huge, I guess, mixed with the rest of the game market itself? Or do you think it'll always stay kind of separate?
Well, I think we're already seeing that with the platform holders, Sony and Microsoft, valuing those exclusives as part of their portfolio because it's really, really hard to lock down arguments for why their platform should be purchased over their competition. So I do think that, you look at it right now, the thing that's setting the PlayStation apart from Xbox One is all their indie exclusives. They're cost-effective ways to lock down exclusive content. It's great for indies, depending on their experiences and their needs. I've heard some horror stories about experiences with one publisher or the other. You hear horror stories about Steam as well, as a platform.
Yeah.
But I think that as the market continues to evolve and as the that part of the business is able to iron out the kind of awkward things, the things that are anti-developer, I think that we're going to see that thrive. And you'll see more and more indie games being sort of held to the same regard as an Assassin's Creed or Call of Duty, but it's still so new, this priority on giving them equal platform to everybody else. I think for me, it's just a matter of I'm worried that's going to become it's going to become as risky as a lot of bigger projects, and it's going to be, lose a little bit of that punk rock aesthetic as it becomes the thing that they see, that these bigger companies see as, oh, this is our easy way to get new content on our platforms. I'm like, I really hope that it doesn't hurt the creative
aspect of it.
Yeah, but it's like any other business. I mean, that same thing has happened to indie films. They start feeling very safe because they aren't willing to take chances with certain creative decisions to that may be true to their artistic voice, but maybe don't play to a larger audience that don't really want to take that many risks. It's a hard thing to make money off of a creative venture anyway. It's that balancing act. So,
and it's very risky too. Especially you have these people who think I'm going to make they see a game like Super Meat Boy or Fez and that did really well, and they think I can make the next one. So it's like, they also have to realize, not to say you can't make the next, great piece of art, but you also have to realize you also have to still have a job too. It's not going to necessarily pay your bills. So.
Right, if you're relying on it to be that thing. There are a lot of games that I love from the indie space that, Candid Conversations, or even in some cases like the developers of Dust Force, which is I love that game. It's like a 2D kind of speed run platformer.
I think I should download it on my 360.
It's really cool. But apparently the sales figures, even like from Humble Bundles. I've seen a lot of interesting data about the different avenues in which people can get their game out there and the risks and rewards of it. And that apparently things like Humble Bundles don't really work out for a lot of publishers, for a lot of developers. Like, it does in some cases, but like if you're relying on Steam or Humble Store or any of those types of platforms to be the main source of your income, it's not always like it's not a guarantee of success if you get on the green light program. Yeah. A lot of people have had bad experiences with that, not really working out for them in terms of making a profit, and that's. I mean, it's a new field in the games industry. It's, of course, it's going to have a lot of problems, but hopefully a lot of that stuff will iron itself out and there'll be a better way of projecting, numbers and things of that sort, like the bigger publishers have.
Yeah, yeah. So. And, and that's what I wanted to come to, especially because now it's like, doing all the podcasts, doing all the reviews, working all the retail stores. You've kind of actually just now have gotten your dream job. You're going to be leaving Dallas pretty soon. Actually, in just a couple of days.
Yeah, it's really crazy because I stupidly booked all the stuff for E3 too. And my job starts right after E3, like within 3 days. And I'm like, I'm just going to be so exhausted. But it's going to be worth it because, I've been working in games retail since high school. I feel like I through working in games retail and in my free time I've written for websites. I do a couple podcasts. I've been one of the head editors and community managers of IndieHaven.com, and so those side projects I started doing just to have an extra creative outlet and also just to learn about what it's like to run those types of organizations and just be more involved with the industry.
And now you're moving out to California to work for a game company. Yeah, that's amazing.
Right. And I wouldn't, honestly, the things, my experiences up until now have given me the skills that I needed to get the job that I wanted. And I think a lot of people, and not to turn this into an anti-college thing, because it's totally not that, but for a lot of people, it's very out of reach to get a degree. And I think we've been in a culture that's been so putting college as the priority, like you have to have a bachelor's or master's degree no matter what field you're in. It's a path, but it's not the path for everybody. And obviously, and for me, like being somebody who the further you get away from high school, the harder it seems to be to go back,
Yeah.
And after a certain point, I started talking to people in the industry. I went to conventions and tried to pick the brain of people who work in the industry. Like, how did you get where you're at? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people fell into it. They're...
So would you say it was about even? At least some of the people you've been talking to was some about... there are the ones with college degrees compared to the ones with that who just kind of got lucky enough to actually kind of find a spot?
I would say so. I mean, you have more consistency with people who are in the technical side, like programming or art departments and things of that sort. But for what I decided eventually what I wanted to do in this field, a lot of people, they have degrees that have nothing to do with what they're doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of it came down to developing those skills on their own through alternative means.
I've known people like that. They go to school, get a job, and I've had an old friend, he got a job in physics, ended up teaching himself how to program. That's what he does now. He's a computer programmer. And so it's like he is doing nothing with the degree he got. Not to say that college wasn't good, but sometimes it's weird how life works that you go for one degree and you end up doing something totally different.
Yeah, and the degree shows that you have work ethic to complete a thing, and that's great. And it shows that you do get skills no matter what degree you're taking that are useful, but it's not necessarily going to be a one-to-one, I get this degree, I'm going to get this job. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I know are, got degrees that they cannot find work in the field that they went to school in. They're stuck in retail jobs just like I was, only I don't have, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in student loan debt,
Like, well, and I think it comes right down to it. It's like, whether or not you're going to college or you're not going to college, it's all about following your passion.
Right.
If you have a passion for something, don't let people keep you from your dreams. There's not a guarantee that you're going to get there, but if you have a dream, follow it for as long as you can and don't let anybody steer you away from it.
Yeah, and for me, like, I think it was just convincing myself for the longest time that I needed that degree to make that dream happen. That was a bit of self-sabotage on my part. I kept telling myself, no, I have to go back. I need to do this. No one's going to want to hire me without a degree. And eventually, I'm talking to people and seeing what their experiences were like. I think the narrative you get when you're young and in school is not necessarily accurate to your options and the way you should approach your life in reality. Like, you don't really know how to talk to people, how to network with people. Those are skills that a lot of times
you don't. Why you went to all these conventions. Why you go to E3, why you went to PAX, to actually talk to these people and know how to start that conversation. It's why, in school, at least at UTD, we always tell our students if they can do it, go to GDC, because you're going to get a first-hand experience talking to the people who work for the game companies who've, published stuff. So it's a good, you start a conversation.
Because what you learn in school, it can apply to what you're doing in real life, but it's more often than not the reality of any workplace or any kind of industry you want to be in. It's best to talk to the people who are in it already and pick their brain about what's their experience, what are things that they felt like. Because a lot of times, at least from my experience in the games industry, people are really nice and approachable. I have been taken aback by how welcoming this industry is to people who are excited and interested to be part of it. And I learned a lot about what I should be focusing on, depending on what I'm wanting to do, from people who are actually doing it.
Yeah.
And that's invaluable. And honestly, those are things that I don't know if I would probably have been in the same position after college had I gone and gotten a degree in marketing than I am now. The only difference is that I saved myself a lot of money. And two, I have a different approach to things. And I feel like because my experience is up to this point, gave me a different perspective on what I do and how I look at things than somebody who was fresh out of college. So I'm not saying, don't go to school. I'm just saying, really look at what you want to do and think about hard what you're interested in, where your passions are, and don't necessarily rule out something just because you think that it's not attainable. That's an easy cop-out to avoid taking a chance on something. I think we're so afraid of potential for failure that a lot of times, especially I think people are in their mid-20s to early 30s, we don't do anything because we're afraid of failure,
Well, I think it's one thing I think we could probably close on. It's one of those things, it's better to have tried than not tried at all.
Yeah.
If you have a dream, it's like, if you fail, you fail, but at least you tried. Instead of having to always wonder in the back of your head, could I have, should I have, but you didn't try, so at least try.
Explore every option possible, and don't sell yourself short, because I did that for the longest time, and I'm not saying I'm full of regret, part of me goes, man, I wish I'd come to this, have this clarity at a younger age. Because I think about how much more I could have accomplished.
But look, you're here now. And you've gotten there. And there's still so much you're going to do in life. So.
Right. Better late than never.
Exactly. And I just want to say this in case the listeners are wondering. We cannot really disclose what the job is right now. Yeah. Because it's one of the things you don't want to jinx until everything's gone through. So
yeah, the ink has not dried. Yeah. But it is something that is a dream job for me, for an organization I am a huge fan of and super excited to be a part of. So I am definitely, it's one of those, it was, a lot of it was not chance, but a lot of amazing coincidences and circumstances lined up to give me an opportunity. And I put myself in a position where I would eventually get an opportunity and had the courage to take it whenever it was in front of me, rather than just tell myself it's not possible or not, a lot of times I think whenever you're applying for jobs, you don't get calls back for a little while, and then you start getting really pessimistic if no one will ever want to talk to you. But that's exactly, it's like winning the lottery. If you don't keep playing, you're never going to win if you never buy a ticket, So, and not to equate this with winning the lottery, but sometimes it does feel that way until you get that success, and you're like, man, why was I ever so negative and pessimistic? It's easy to slip into that state whenever you're not getting an instant feedback from people. So,
well, congratulations on the job.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And do you plan on keeping up with a lot of the stuff you've been writing for Indie Haven or the podcast?
I intend to. It just depends, because whenever you get an industry job, there's always, they don't want any conflict of interest.
Exactly.
And I hope so, because I am really, really passionate about games, about the indie space especially, and just getting to talk to developers and other people in the creative side of things. Because I find the creative process so fascinating. It's not something I'm really good at. I have, like everybody, I have game ideas, but, ideas don't really account for a whole lot. So I love talking to people about the process and sort of where they got their ideas and what the struggles they have. So, yeah, I hope to keep doing, working with Indie Haven. And I love doing podcasts. It's just so much fun to have a creative voice in
exactly.
some fashion.
Yeah.
So,
well, again, congratulations, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, no problem.
And before I forget, this is Kyle Condes with Indie Game Nation. Catch you all later.